Well, I was really interested in the social scene in Manchester in terms of the social problems. How do you see it? Increasing, decreasing?
I think, statistically, the north of the United Kingdom is a lot worse than the south.
Mm-hmm. I've always heard of that, yes.
And that's about poverty more than anything. Mm-hmm. Because without good income, you don't get good education, you don't get good food, etc., etc. Mm-hmm. So you don't get that nurture. And of course, the weather has a lot to play with it as well. So in the south of the United Kingdom, the weather's a lot nicer than in the north.
It's rain and rain and more rain here.
Mm-hmm.
Although I saw the statistics that actually Manchester isn't in the top five of rainiest places. I think, what was it? It was Bristol, number one. Cardiff, and I think parts of Scotland.
Mm-hmm.
So everyone always told me Manchester is the rainiest place. Isn't that so? It's just a good point. You knew that.
Mm-hmm.
It's just a bad reputation.
I think with Manchester, it's not that it rains a lot when it rains, it just rains all the time a little bit.
Oh, I see. Trickles you to death.
Yeah.
So what you're both working together? What are you hoping to achieve? Thankless task.
Yeah, well, my work's predominantly with young women,
mm-hmm.
and we look at six areas of wellness through a health project,
mm-hmm.
And they're physical, emotional, spiritual, social and community, occupational, and intellectual.
Mm-hmm.
So we do a variety of activities all based around promoting all of those different areas. So it's quite a holistic approach, I think, to
mm-hmm.
to health.
Mm-hmm.
I think a main reason for doing our work is to build self-esteem within the women and feelings of empowerment and feelings of community, I think. So that's the aim. I don't know if we achieve it all the time, but mm-hmm. it keeps chipping away. You know?
Mm-hmm. You both work at the same on the same project.
Similar but different when we use it.
Similar time, but I work for the National Health Service,
mm-hmm.
And my approach covers the City of Manchester, working with all sorts of different young people,
mm-hmm.
doing all sorts of different things with them. We focus on wellness, so it's not focused on illness.
I was interested to see one statistic about the what used to be called unwed mothers. And it said that most of them were sure that the man that fathered their child was going to marry them, and it rarely turned out that way. Did you see those statistics? I was quite fascinated. That's quite fascinating. I could dig it out for you if you want. It looked a little incredulous, but I was shocked that most of them did think, even at, you know, after they gave birth and like that, well, it's no problem, he's going to marry me, and rarely did it happen.
Mm-hmm.
I felt very sad seeing that. You mentioned you have six areas you target, and spiritual is one of them. How would you go about the spiritual?
What we have done in the past is we've done things like Tai Chi and yoga and meditation, and we had Mind Body Spirit Day a couple of months ago, where we had someone doing Reiki and Indian head massage. But the nature, I think, of each of the different areas of wellness is that they're so interdependent that I think the positive social and community aspect raises people's spirits. I think sometimes we have to disguise, in a way, the spiritual element to convince young people to do it, if that makes sense. Because if you just phrase something as spiritual, people that has a lot of different connotations for people, and it's sometimes people just completely switch off. So it's sort of sneaking it in sometimes until people get used to it, and then they'll recognise it as what it is.
Well, what keeps you both going day after day? You know, certainly it's not a huge salary.
No.
Just trying to do your little bit to help. That's nice.
I think you get to a point in your life where you are self-motivated and are very able and very skilled and want to share that with other people so that other people's lives become a little bit better than what they already are. You can't solve issues for people, people have got to solve them themselves, and you can help them. I think the motivation is knowing that there's potential. When people reach potential, there's still more potential to reach.
So you can see that your skills make a difference.
Yeah, over time.
The persons are more productive citizens, they become more productive citizens, or they drop their dysfunctional behavior, or
become happier with themselves, or know where to seek support.
That's interesting. It's amazing. They become happier within themselves. How do you quantify that?
I don't think you can, but I think a lot of, increasingly, I think my understanding of what we do is moving away from numbers.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we never work with massive amounts of people, and I sometimes find that difficult to grapple with because you wouldn't know how it makes a difference, but actually working with a few people over a long period of time makes a really big difference, and that's, you can't quantify it, but you know it's there, you know it's important, you know that it's helping you make a
difference. Yeah, I always thought about that, like working with a few people. It does, I guess it can seem like a drop in the bucket, and like, but I guess what else can you do? I mean, other than, it's like, all right, I'm just doing what I can do, and working with a few people, and can't help everybody, but.
Do you find that in what you do?
No, because trying to always expand the network. I've been traveling on every continent for 25 years now, more than 25 years, including time underground in communist Europe and communist China. So, probably the times when I felt most hard-pressed and not discouraged, but very under great duress with, during communist days in Eastern Europe. Yeah, that was tough. But coming from New York and California, where I grew up, and then seeing, you know, things like the Berlin Wall and, you know, KGB and all this kind of thing, just persons whose only purpose in life was to make people miserable. It was just really shocking. I mean, it was kind of, you know, it was just very depressing to see. That was very tough on the nerves. But since then, as long as you can see a network of competent persons expanding, in, at least in my line of work, it's okay. We don't expect everyone's going to want to learn how to control their senses, for example. It'd be great if they would, but... We're trying to teach people that to get to the root of all their problems, they've got to learn how to control their mind and senses. and get in touch with their real identity, their spiritual identity, rather than misidentifying themselves as matter. And then once you misidentify yourself as just material, naturally you seek material gratification. And then the whole thing goes downhill from there. So we try to impress upon people that without purifying their consciousness, they're never going to be satisfied. Because they'll be like a fish out of water. It's not the nature of the material atmosphere to grant you deep satisfaction. It's just not going to happen. It's simply the promise. The promise is never fulfilled. It's like advertising on television. So, I see that the people today have so, their heads are full of so many visions that are not going to work out. They're not going to be thoroughly satisfied. Just be promissory happiness. And so we think that, according to the ancient Vedic knowledge of India, that the problem is coming because they have a materialistic conception of their self-identity, which pushes them to satisfy themselves with matter, which is not going to happen. No one values mind and sense control. What's the point of that, I think? I was speaking at, maybe you were there, when I was talking at, I think you were, you know, at university here. Which one was it?
The university.
Yeah, and there were some students, and I asked them, well, what do you do on a Friday night? And they kind of looked at me like I was crazy. I'm just asking you that. We do on a Friday night, we get wasted. And so I said, well, you know, how is that? You know, I travel all over the world, so I like to hear the different styles of getting wasted. Yeah, well, you know, you go to a pub, you dance, you drink. And I said, what about the next day? The next day you feel horrible. Splitting headache. You don't get up till 4 o'clock in the afternoon. So I said, well, why go through all that? I said, well, you don't understand. Just to have those few hours of happiness on Friday night was all worth it. And then one girl, she was studying to be a doctor. She told me, you know what the most exquisite delight is? The most rare thrill is when you wake up on a Saturday morning and someone's there next to you and you can't figure out how they got there and they all laugh. So, I tell this story wherever I go around the world. That's interesting. Nothing unusual, but how do you get persons to actually be able to do themselves any good in such a society that's just pushing persons to be consumers and to think that you can be happy with material things? How do you do it? I was wondering. I studied a lot of sociology and all those kind of things during my university days. And at that time, in the 70s, early 70s, students were much more socially active than they are now. Probably you would be normal for students then, whereas now you're kind of might be seen as crusaders and golden-hearted, you know, Florence Nightingales or something. But back then in the 70s, you would have been part. You would have been normal, you know, with a vision to help, you know, wanting to care. Everyone was like that then. It's not like that now. I guess you've noticed. But yeah, you remind me of, like, you know, late 60s, early 70s. You know, you want to make an impact. You just don't want to please yourself. You want to help others. And I was also like that. I studied very deeply the sociological reasons for social problems. But persons like you are quite rare these days. I guess you've seen that. I guess everyone's wondering how long can you last before you realize you just get a job that brings the money and, you know, just take home a nice paycheck and sit in front of your big widescreen TV and raise some kids to be the same. I guess some people are wondering when you'll wake up and realize the world is the way it is, you can't do anything about it, you know. There's poor people, there's disturbed people, there's terrorists, to be honest. Anyone ever say like that to you?
No. I think I'm very privileged because of the people I know and the circles I mix in are very similar. Mm-hmm. So I don't feel isolated or alone in what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. There's always other people to draw on to do things. And I've been doing it for a long time. And the old people that I work with don't have to work with me, they do it because they want to. Mm-hmm. We're not social workers. Mm-hmm. We're youth workers, it's a different mm-hmm. relationship. Mm-hmm. So it's not a compulsory relationship, it's a voluntary relationship. Mm-hmm. It's about how you treat people, and I think if you treat people nicely and with respect, and you can reaffirm where you stand on things, then eventually people will take that on and become part of that, because they do it of their own will.
And then?
And then they go on to talk to other people.
And what is the change that you see?
What I see is over a long period of time, when young people have grown up and they come back and they say, thank you, that experience was really worthwhile and this is what I've done with it.
And how are they different in terms of their lifestyle, their interactions with society?
What I've found and what I hope is that they're far more cooperative than they would have been. Mm-hmm. It's a difficult age because we've come through the Thatcher years and we're still in a lot of that idea that if you don't do things for yourself, you don't do things for others. Mm-hmm. So it's a hard cycle to break. Mm-hmm. It's about, you know, so to me it's not what you do, it's the way that you do it. And the way that you do it is to try and foster that sense of cooperation.
At the same time though, I think sometimes you can feel, you know, I've been told a lot of times of this halcyon age of the 70s and, you know, the late 60s and 70s, when everything seemed to be going in the right direction and there was so much happening. And I think sometimes people look back with rose-tinted spectacles and I wonder whether this is true as it really was. But at the same time, having worked at the student union and knowing how difficult it was to get people to come together, mm-hmm. and then meeting on this weekend just gone somebody who worked there 20 years ago, who had meetings that we could get a dozen people there for, and that's a good turnout. There was 200 people there for, and that was a weekly turnout for just a meeting. And that change, I think, is difficult to accept because you wonder what's happened to all those people, what do they do instead, and are they, even if you work as hard as you can you ever build that back together again, or what is the best response to that?
That's the end of the 60s and beginning of the 70s. Yes, I don't have a rose-tinted vision of that. Because they didn't really get to the crux of the problem. There's a lot of idealism, a lot of, you know, smile on your brother, love one another. But they never got to the root spiritual problems that were causing all the... that would actually prevent that idealism of that time from lasting. The bottom line was, in the end of the 60s and early 70s, gradually the young people started to realize, hey, I'm just into me and my senses. That's actually what it's all about. And why go through all this idealistic talk? And so then, by the mid-70s, all that altruism and superficial good feeling just faded, and we went right into the me generation. You know? Hey, yeah. I remember saying to my brother, he's 12 years younger than me, so he missed that period. So he finished university, and while he was at the university, in law school, he got a job working with Nationwide Network in the USA as a TV news ferret. Just going around finding good stories, a summer job. And so, my middle brother, who's a year and a half younger than me, was like getting on this case. How could you be part of this imperialistic, you know, this oppressive, the system, you know, Nationwide new TV news system, you know, keeping the people in chains, bewildering them. My brother, younger brother, just looked at him and said, "You're just a relic of the 60s. I'm doing what fulfills me. I get a good feeling by doing this. That's all that matters." My middle brother, he was shocked. But that's what my youngest brother told me. "You're just a relic from the 60s. I feel fulfilled doing this. That's it. Nothing more needs to be said." So I feel that because there was no deep spiritual understanding behind all that 60s counterculturalism, therefore it had to fade. Sooner or later, everyone realized that, you know, it's just all about gratifying our senses. And then they realized that that's the business of life that's going on no matter what, so just try to suit yourself. All the flower power started turning into hard drugs, and rip-offs and all sorts of things like that. And by the mid-70s, it was gone. And everyone just settled down to business as usual, how to take care of me and mine. So at that point, I realized, actually, I could see such a thing was coming. So I thought there has to be a core spiritual solution beyond just religious sentiment or religious belief. There has to be actual distribution of processes for spiritual experience that knowing who made a difference. I remember I was into student radicalism and changing society politically for a short time. My first year at university, they're having a big radical students weekend. At that time, where I went to university, Yale University, it was still all boys, all men. And they would bus in the ladies for special weekends from the prestige ladies schools around New England. You know, they got that system from the British, you know. You know, you have Harvard, Yale, and you have for the men, and you had Radcliffe and Vassar for the ladies. And so, the radical men were going to have a big radical weekend. And, they're going to have seminars and symposiums, on how to help uplift the people, how to get into the community and, inspire the community to develop itself and, all that kind of talk. And it's just all good, but... So they were sounding the drum, we gotta get with the people, and mind you, this is at a university that costs $25,000 US a year. But anyway, you're gonna be with the people, and solidarity with the people, and go into the community and build up infrastructure, and so they planned out the seminars, the revolutionary seminars throughout the day, and the obligatory walking trips into the community, you know, from the ivy towers of the university into the community to show solidarity. And they laid out the whole schedule. And then, finally, I was just one guy, one of the leaders stood up and said, okay, that's it for the seminars and symposiums. And you all know what comes next. Everybody yelled out, party, party! That's right. So then he said, but, you know, let me just ask one favor. Brothers, let me just ask one favor. If 2 o'clock in the morning comes after the party's over and you haven't made it back to a motel room with one of the sisters, the revolutionary sisters, why don't you just admit that you failed and help us clean up the party room? And I just said, oh my goodness. At that point, I just said, forget politics. This is ridiculous. Yeah. You haven't made it back to a motel room with one of the revolutionary sisters. So why don't you stick around and help us clean up the party room, you know? Do your duty, you know? For the revolution and clean. Admit you failed in the goal of life, and just help us clean up the party room. So at that point, I just said, I just was disgusted. Reminded me of, I don't know if you've ever seen that movie, Marat Sade. It's a famous French satire. And it's like a satirical musical about pointlessness of politics. And so then the high point of this whole musical is, it's like the set in the times of the French Revolution. So then the men and women pair off, and they just hold each other's hands and swing back and forth, you know, and say, what's the point of a revolution without general copulation? That's what it's reminded me of. So I just gave up on the political scene at that point. I said, this is, without purification of consciousness, this is not going to go anywhere. As long as people think they're the body, identifying with the body and its needs, they're not going to be able to help themselves. You really can't do much to help them other than temporary patchwork. So I decided then and there that the real help is in terms of helping consciousness, helping people to purify their consciousness. After I graduated from Yale, you're supposed to head right to AT&T and IBM or places like that, but I ducked all that and just took a quote-unquote lowly job as a youth counselor in New York City High School for a half a year before I started doing what I'm doing now. So I took it very seriously that unless people purify their consciousness and have some other alternative to live for other than I am this body, I should please my body, there's going to be no peace, there'll be no real change in society. So I wanted to sacrifice myself for significant, deep-rooted change. Now you might say, well, that's why some people become priests and so on and so forth. But I also was not impressed by just cursory religious superficialities, the way live for the most part. I thought if there's such a thing as, if we're actually spirit soul, if we're not material, then there must be such a thing as spiritual pleasure. So how do you get people in touch with spiritual pleasure? That seems to be the crux of the whole situation, because you can't stop them from trying to enjoy. So I'm sure you too, you know, you want pleasure, you want happiness. You don't like, when weekend comes, you don't sit in your flats and just say, we can't be happy because so many people are suffering. You want to be happy, right? So, How is it that people can actually taste genuine spiritual happiness? Because they want pleasure, but the problem is with material pleasure. So I thought if I could address this situation, that would be the best work I could do for humanity. For our trip of this Krishna conscious work. I wanted to go at the root of the problem. The root of the problem is people don't know what they are. Am I this body? Am I the mind? Yeah. Am I spirit? I mean, so many people will say, I'm spiritual. Or they'll say their boyfriend or girlfriend is spiritual. I'm like, oh, what does this really mean? I wanted to find the most comprehensive spiritual knowledge possible in order to apply the best therapy. I was looking for the greatest therapeutic solutions. I studied a lot at the university, different cultures, different histories, and saw what happens whenever there's some kind of political change, economic change. Not much changes within the core of people's hearts. I can see that the main problem people have is they want to be happy, but they don't know how to. They try to enjoy materially. You can't stop them from trying to enjoy it. It's impossible. You have to teach them what is real pleasure. Everyone wants pleasure. You want pleasure. Those you're helping, they want pleasure. But what is the nature of real pleasure? Real pleasure cannot be found simply in the realm of nature. Now, if you ask so many people, what are you? Very few laypersons will want to say, I'm just a bunch of chemicals. Very few. Would you say that? You're just a bunch of chemicals. What do you say? So then, what is it that is about you that is more than just chemicals? That we require to understand and investigate. That's the greatest career, the greatest calling. Otherwise, we're always trying to satisfy something we're not. I say I think I'm spiritual, but I keep acting to please myself materially. And because people are trying to please themselves materially, they have such wild senses. One 21-year-old was telling me how much, you know, the average young person spends clubbing in London on a weekend. I was shocked. If you're a working guy, fresh out of school, even just out of high school or university, and he said, you'll spend probably minimum, you know, 160 pounds for Friday and Saturday night on clubbing and ecstasy. Minimum. Transportation to get back and forth to the club. Ecstasy. Club fees. You have to buy water. Make the water very expensive. So club makes money off of it. I said, you don't get through that weekend without at least spending 160 pounds for Friday and Saturday night. I talked to so many young persons. When I was spending more time in Manchester last year, I talked to quite a few, what do you call them, Mancunians? Yeah. And they said, yeah, that's the club culture is really so prevalent. And because people want to enjoy. They told me, you know, it's not the girl-boy thing that's so important. That can happen during the week. You don't need a big deal about that. That could happen the drop of a hat, so to speak. But, you know, the club scene is the ecstasy, the feeling that the drug gives you when you're dancing to the music. You do that on the weekends, and during the weekdays, you have your boy-girl liaisons. You know, it's a supplement.
I don't know whether that's true. I think probably whether people admit it or not, but that people use
those opportunities of going out and alcohol and drugs to find people to have connections with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I would think so.
I don't think so.
So what can you tell the people you're dealing with, you know? Suppose they ask you, okay, well, what do you guys do to enjoy? What would you say? Sit at home listening to classical music? Or
I don't think we say, I think we do. Mm-hmm. And often I say this, that the young people I work with, a lot of them, would be just really happy if I just took them to the supermarket and did my own shopping and chatted to them. I don't have to do great things, I just have to go around the ordinary life, and they're happy just to have the company and somebody paying interest in them.
How old are they?
It's not threatening.
How old are they?
14 up to 25.
Yeah,
I see. So it's quite a broad age range. Mm. And I think they're just happy to have somebody interested in them who's not threatening them.
Mm. Yeah, that certainly helps. Someone interested in them is not threatening them.
I think if they ask me what I do, I would say work with you lot, because that's what I do on a lot of my weekends and evenings. Mm-hmm. And that is a job, but it's a job that I do for myself too. As much for myself as for others, because I think that's a necessary balance to do a really good job, because I know that I can feel very complete within myself by seeing the benefit in other people. And maybe that's maybe it's not material, maybe it's a different sort of kick, I don't know. But I think that I don't believe in being selfish or selfless. I think you need to be somewhere in the middle, because if you're selfless, you're not teaching other people about what it means to be fair, and if you're selfish, then you're being unfair. So I think it's got to be, the reason why I do my job is because I love it, but I know it makes a good change in the world as well.
So if someone asked you, oh, who are you anyway, and who am I, what would you say?
Asking.
Who are you? What are you? I mean, are you this body? Are you this mind? What are you? What's the nature of you? Would you just say, well, my name is, and I was born in Manchester, I'm a young lady, or what would you say? What is your identity?
I think it depends on the context, and it depends on what you're, how much you want to communicate to somebody. Because I could give a whole variety of different answers. I could talk specifically about my job, and Sally was saying the other day, we often, and it's quite a Western thing, to put your job as one of the key factors of your identity. So, so not who are you, but what do you do is the first question. But I could say, you know, I'm a person with ambitions and hopes and dreams and experiences, and that's who I am. You know, I think you can, saying is one thing, thinking of being something is a little bit different.
Well, you didn't have this job all your life, and you may not have it all your life in the future. You didn't have it all your life in the past. So, of course, it's doing a nice thing, but still we could say it's a temporary designation.
Mm, it depends though. See, I don't, very rarely will I say work, I'm going to work. Mm-hmm. I won't say that. Mm-hmm. I'll say I'm going to do this project, I'm going out on this trip, I'm meeting these people. I wouldn't say I'm going to work, because often it's not viewed as a chore. It's viewed as a delight. It's this idea that some people live to work and some people work to live. And I think my job, I live to do that work.
Now, still, that work, you didn't have it all your life before, and yeah, who knows what might happen in the future. And so how do you identify yourself? I mean, there's so many temporary layers or roles or designations that you could say you have. I am a lady, this is my name, this is where I was born, but these things are kind of external, aren't they?
They are.
So what is the real internal thing? What's the internal reality that doesn't change amidst all these social roles and designations?
For me, I think it does change. I think it is about my skills and my abilities and my willingness. And that can change. But that's my constant, but it also changes.
But what is the nature of the core of your existence?
For me?
For everyone.
For me? Yeah. I can only talk for me. I think it's a vocation to be supported and helpful.
And what is that nature, that I, that wants to be supportive and helpful? What is it composed of?
It's about having those experiences that have shaped me, that mean not to be negative, to try and foster cooperation with people, to try and encourage people to be their own best therapists, so that they understand themselves and their abilities.
Okay. So then they would say, well, do you understand yourself?
To a great deal, yes.
Okay, what are you?
I'm a person who can be quite open, but I can be quite closed. It depends on what role I'm playing and who I'm with.
Well, these are, one could say these are marginal characteristics, but what is the intrinsic nature of you? What is it composed of? It's like, this is composed of wood. This is a book. It's composed of, paper and black ink on it. Black ink, is in the form of words which symbolize various meanings. My hand is composed of flesh and blood and bones. And look, there's the hand. You see some tan there, some brown, some reddish. You see some Scottish on my mother's side. You see some also reddish Native American. Is in brownish, little African. So it's just something. What is that? Me? What composes your identity? They ask you. Okay. We want you to help us, but who are you? What is the nature of the self? If you just tell them these marginal things, I can be this. Can be very open. But what's the nature of that I?
I think it's quite fluid and flexible. It's open to other people's interpretations as well as mine. So I can say what I think my being is, but that might not resonate for other people. They might have experience with me and feel that what I'm saying is not what they're experiencing.
Well, for example, are you this body? Is that all that you are? Or is there something more to you than just the body?
There's more than the body.
Okay, and what would that be?
I guess there have been occasions in my life where I feel I've moved from my body, and this is particularly happened in practicing yoga, where I feel
out of the body experience.
Yeah.
Quite common.
Yeah. So I feel there is something spiritual.
Okay, what is it? Can you tell us more about that?
Not really, because I've not had that many experiences of it.
Ah, very good. Very good. So, it would seem that whatever it was that left your body, you had this distinct experience that you were separate from your body. Some people have it near-death experiences, others just while they're sleeping at night, they start floating out of their body. So you had the distinct experience of being located outside your body. What was this thing outside your body?
Sensationally, it was very calm. And felt very unthreatening.
beyond that, I can't explain it.
Didn't you like wonder, like, wait a minute, what am I doing? Identifying with the body or thinking this body can please me, when just see, I'm different from the body. What is the nature of this thing that's different from the body?
Yeah, it wasn't a threat, so...
No, it's not a threat, it's a doorway to great possibilities.
Sure, I think we only question things that are threats, though. I think if things are pleasurable...
That's a very good point, very good point, yes. But an intelligent person, especially like you two, ordinary persons, you should move beyond that to question, what is that? What was it about me that I was separate from my body? I had a distinct impression, I'm not dreaming. What's the nature of my existence that I could clearly see the body was one thing, and I, whatever that I is, it's something else. But if you start grappling with those kind of investigations, I think that's the level upon which you can get the most help to people. If you could figure out how to satisfy that real you that was separate from the body, and what are the needs of that real you that's separate from the body, I think then you'd really be on the brink of quite powerful youth work. Not only for the young, but for all ages. You have that feeling, maybe I'm not the body. But what is the composition of this entity who's feeling I'm not the body? And how do you satisfy that entity?
I guess I'm satisfied enough that those moments when that happens, and that's fine, that's enough for me. Because every other aspect of what I do actually is quite about things about the body. You know, right. Every week those young people will turn up and say mm-hmm. strange things.
Mm-hmm.
So that's far more immediate than me having the time or energy to actually concentrate.
Yes, they require food, but if you're not the body, it would seem that there's even a greater need. Not to downplay the need for food and housing, but it may not be the most important thing, even though it has to be there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But as long as it has to be there, like I was thinking before I came here today, and we stopped off to get some water, so I was thinking I'm thirsty, and if I come here thirsty and I'm thinking about my thirst, how can I think and listen and understand? Because my mind and body is automatically distracted, and you know, and I know there are people that will fast, and I know that people can train themselves and their mind and their body and their spirit perhaps to overcome that. But I think in order to get to that position, you need to have those things fulfilled previously. I think you need to be on that level of having the needs, physical needs met, to be able to explore further.
I agree with you that yes, it certainly makes it easier for people when they have their basic needs filled to think about the deeper issues of life. But nevertheless, it's a fact, the deep issues of life have to be solved, and that's where the real satisfaction is. But that, just because that's where the real satisfaction and solutions are, doesn't mean you neglect the other things. I don't see it as an either or. It's like you have a car, the car requires petrol. Now, just because you put petrol into the car because it requires it, doesn't mean that you're satisfying yourself as if you drank the petrol. Are you? You have your clothes, you take care of your clothes, but that doesn't mean you think you're the clothes and it's the most important thing in the world. So, I think if we put the bodily help in this proper context, without denying it, but just put it in its proper context, its proper, give it its proper prioritization, then that would free us up for spending some necessary time on what is the number one priority. Not that you ignore the other things, but I think your experience you're telling you about, which is common, OBEs, out-of-body experiences, is a statistic that a surprising number, what's like 20% of university students in England have had an OBE, something like that. I researched the situation. So, prime necessity in life would be to try to understand what is the nature of that entity that was separate from the body and how to satisfy that entity. Doesn't mean you ignore the body, but it's just not as important. Although it can't be ignored, its needs have to be filled. I would think the challenge for you two is how to go on with your very nice contribution to society that you're making now, while at the same time recognizing that there are even higher priorities.
I think, on a personal level, in my life, I feel very content and very happy. And I think, in a sense, it would be unfair for me not to acknowledge the fact that where I'm at and my experiences in my life up to now puts me as one of the most fortunate people in the whole world. And to go inside myself, although that has benefit, is sometimes secondary to a primary need to give something back to all those in so much greater need of, you know, those fundamentals around being safe, around food, around education.
The idealist amongst the Russian socialist communists, they said the same thing. But okay, what she experienced when she's out of her body, that might be even more, a much more fundamental need than the food, the water, like that, without denying those things. It's just on the list of priorities. If we could cope with what was the nature that's her, that was outside the body, we might be able to really get to the root of the problems of the human existence, while dealing with the food, the, you know, clothing and water problems. Not to deny those, of course. But why does it have to be one or the other? And then if you're going to make a priority, why shouldn't the priority be to satisfy the real self, whatever that is? It's like that self that was separate from her body. How do you satisfy that? That could actually be the most powerful help to give. Very interesting. Said that experience. You had an experience like that also?
Yeah. No.
That was common. Most people think it's unique, but I've studied the statistics. It's quite common. And especially with near-death experiences, so it's very common. You know about that, like someone who's died and, or clinically pronounced dead, and they can, they feel themselves separate from the body, and they see that their body on the operating table and the doctors pronouncing them dead, and then they come back into their body and the doctors are, I thought you were gone, you were clinically dead. So I began to consider that. Well, I also did youth work. Yeah. I thought, well, how do I get to the root of this problem? I don't think material happiness can satisfy anyone. Yes, I agree everyone should have their fair share of food and water and this and that. But there seems to be something else that's really missing. And then in traveling around India, I could see, I've been to villages where people practically have nothing, yet they are so much happier in any places I've seen. So, I would appeal to you to address those points at some point in your wonderful careers. How can you actually give or distribute to people a genuine spiritual experience of their non-material identity and how to satisfy that non-material identity? So I would advise you not to forget this experience you had. And it's actually quite a very significant thing. You realize there's something about me that's not just chemicals, and I'm not just a body of biochemistry. What's going on here? So this is the work that I'm dedicated to doing. Doesn't deny material help, and I'm wearing clothes. I mean, of course, another point is people really don't know how to even live a material life these days. They don't know how to eat properly.
Where does the idea of material end? Because a lot of what we do costs money, obviously, but the output isn't generally producing anything solid. It's definitely those abstract things around confidence, around self-esteem, around feeling sense of belonging and love, I suppose, and, you know.
If you're going to want your own, you're not going to just go through your whole life just, you know, helping others. You're going to want your own. You're going to want your own family, your own scene. It just, that's the way it happens, you know. You're going to want your own nest.
But that's not exclusive.
Exactly. Similarly, I'm saying is to deal with your spiritual issues are not exclusive, but it's the most important thing. When you have your child, that child will be most important, but it doesn't mean you shut out the whole world. Exactly. But you are going to want to nest and have your own, you know, birdies chirping around you in your nest. And that is going to take time out from your wider interests. Mess up?
I don't know. Mm-hmm. I don't know because I don't know what the future holds.
Yeah.
And right now, I think I'm already playing those roles with a lot of young people I work with.
I can understand that. I can understand that. I don't have any biological children, but I have heaps of non-biological children. I understand what you're saying. But you think that might be just the way you're going to express yourself for the duration?
I know what's happening now, and I know what's happening when I retire. So between now and then, which is about 22 years, I don't know what's going to happen.
Like I'm the kind of person, I really seriously feel for those people who were on the tube in London and on the bus who got blown up. I reveal that. What was it? Suppose that was me, you know. They had their career plans, they had their hopes, their dreams, their loves, their sadnesses. Now what is their situation? It's like you were outside your body. What was your situation? You're outside the body. It's not supposed to happen according to materialistic science. Right? You know that. But you have that experience. You know. No one can tell you any different, right? You know. So this is a great challenge. I would ride on that horse, not only in terms of showing you the shortcomings of contemporary science, but also to show you that we're missing the point in terms of where we should apply the main priority of our energies in helping people. If you could figure out how to nourish and nurture that you that was separate from your body, I would say that you'd be in a position to do the greatest good for everyone. Not to say you're not doing any good now, but just the greatest good.
The trouble is with things abstract is that they're open to individual interpretation, and I might feel that I'm separate from my body, but the only way to gratify that other self is through ownership of things or people, through fighting with people, that feeds that ego, if you like, which might be the thing outside myself, and that might be how I interpret that soul or that spirit, whereas another person might feel, well, that spirit or that soul is beyond all those feelings, mm-hmm. and it's this, you know, this right. thing that just exists.
Therefore, it seems our greatest need is to get some concrete, comprehensive knowledge of what is our spiritual identity. Yeah, I agree. Yeah, otherwise, someone will say this, someone will say that. And if we can get that and then distribute it to others, this is the greatest welfare work. Actually, you can feed someone and then they'll be hungry tomorrow. You can get them clothes and the clothes will wear out and they'll need more clothes tomorrow. So even though it's a fact we need food and clothes, still, if we can teach them how to deal with their spiritual identity, that's the lasting solution. So my hope is that one day you both will not only be, you know, youth workers in terms of, in the conventional sense, but also that you can distribute experience of the spiritual reality as the ultimate solution for social material ills. That's what we're trying to do in Krishna consciousness. We recognize that living entities eternally pleasure seeking, but does not know what real pleasure is. To really help people. This is another thing I realized in my university days. It takes a qualification to love. It takes a qualification to care. You've got to know what you're doing. Otherwise it's easy to say, I love, I care, I want to help. But if you really want to love, care, and help, you require qualification. What is the nature of the self? How is the self under the hallucination that it's the body? What is the nature of the pure self, pure consciousness? So I just decided that if I really want to care, to love, to help, I've got to deal with those issues. Otherwise, I could be hurting people in the name of care and love. You know, there's some diseases that you're not supposed to eat, like tuberculosis, I believe, is one. Maybe you have typhoid, something. Yeah, typhoid. Common in India. Suppose you saw someone in the hospital who had typhoid and they weren't eating. Maybe they're just being drip-fed intravenously with some nutrients. And you felt so sorry for that person. You felt compassion, and you came back with a big banquet. While the doctor wasn't looking, you gave it to the person. And then the doctors found out. What do you think the doctors would say? Oh, they'd be so angry. Kill this person. You know, give this banquet to a typhoid patient. But you said, but I wanted to care. I wanted to help a person who was not eating nicely. I wanted to make this person happy. So my point is that if you really want to care and reach out to others, that's a big responsibility, that's a big qualification. You have to know what is the nature of the self so you can touch it. But you can't touch the real self with material methods. You have to know how to touch spiritually. That is the purpose of Krishna consciousness. So I would implore you both, you have such nice hearts, very well grounded. I would implore you both that you, just like you have that experience which no one can deny, and it's more common than you think, I would save the main aspect of your life for that kind of help, that kind of therapy, along with the other nice things you're doing. You also have the desire for pleasure, the capacity for pleasure, but it won't be satisfied by material methods. You've widened your circle of care and concern beyond the usual selfish circle of that normal people stay confined within. But can you become even wider in terms of dealing with the spiritual reality, not just the shadow realm of matter? So those are my thoughts for such noble persons as yourself. You both have a lot of determination and drive. If you just put it all on the material platform, you'll be frustrated. It won't work, as so many have found. Yes, you can say, well, you made some difference, but you probably could do much more if you combine the material help with the spiritual help. Spiritual help begins with understanding. We're not the body, we're pure spirit soul. That's the first instruction that Krishna gives in Bhagavad Gita. So I would recommend you, in your spare time, while administering to the wounds of societies, outcasts or forgotten ones, that you put some time in for understanding the science of the soul, the science of the Supreme Soul. That is Krishna consciousness. And then you'll both be very powerful helpers of humanity. That is my view. Any questions about that? It sounds plausible, or?
Hello?
Far above you, or? You're not going to forget that experience you had. What is it? Simply at the time of death. What? You say you know that you're not just a body. So what? What's the difference between a dead body and a living body? What leaves at the time of death? Does something leave? You already had the experience. Something can go on.
Probably be already on the phone.
All right. Tell them to give me a call back in 15 minutes. What's it going to be at the time of death? You've already experienced something independent of the body. Now, if you could teach others about it, that there is an existence and experience beyond the states of the body, you could understand what that is, that would give people the greatest hope, the greatest. That in spite of all bodily changes, something's going on. What is that then? This is the beginning of Krishna consciousness, to think like this. So I just want to provoke you a little bit, don't mind. You all are putting so much energies into helping people. So why not offer the complete solution, material and spiritual? But spiritual just doesn't mean, you know, I appreciate what you're saying in the beginning, you know, a bit of Indian head massage, a bit of Tai Chi, a bit of this and that. We actually got to get to the root of what is our spiritual identity. Is there something about us that cannot be explained materially? And how do we nurture and nourish that part of us that can't be nurtured materially? If you can solve this riddle, you'll be able to give the greatest help, the greatest care, the greatest love. And I think that's what you two want to do. You want to give the greatest love. That is actually your ambition. You've gotten that far in your evolution to understand that to give the greatest love is the greatest pleasure.
I don't think that's it for me. I don't think it's about giving the greatest love. I think it's about unlocking that ability in everybody to understand one another and look for the similarity and respect the difference. But for me, just to be all full up of love and just give it out, I think is a bit of a fruitless task, because I think it's about everybody everywhere exchanging it all the time.
What is it? What is real love? Is it based on the body, or is it something more? How do you deal with love in terms of when she was outside her body? How do you love that?
Because I think you do love the essence. People that you know well, you do love the essence of them.
How do you love the essence? How do you grab onto it? What do you do?
You don't try and grab onto it. Because you
can't
grab onto
it?
Something. You just...
How do you interact with it? The essence, as you call
through
it.
Through being...
Where do you find it?
You don't look for it. You find it through being with people, through taking time with people, through their actions, you and your actions and your interactions, and you work on a level which isn't necessarily vocal, it's not necessarily with gestures, it's understandings.
What is the nature of this essence? What's it composed of? With cream or peaches or
it's obviously not tangible.
Tangible materially.
Yeah.
So then how do you relate to it spiritually?
Senses. Your senses.
With?
Your senses.
Which kind of senses?
You feel it. You sense it. You know which people you want to be with, which people you don't want to be with. You know which people are going to help you feel calm and grounded, and you know which people, just by being near them, are going to make you feel less calm and less grounded.
But everyone has this spirit soul.
And that's very individual, so it's really difficult to get into that individual. So my out-of-body experience is exceptionally individual.
Well, it's quite common.
It may be common, but there was only me in that experience.
Right. Now, what is the spiritual reality that you're a part of? Your body is a part of the material situation, you know, flesh and blood, it's matter. But what is that spiritual entity that was outside the body? What is the spiritual reality that that's a part of? So this is Krishna consciousness that I'm teaching you. That spiritual you that was separate from the body is part of a bigger spiritual reality. So what's the nature of that bigger spiritual reality? What is our relationship with it? These are very fascinating questions. So I leave you two to think about those things. My job is just to provoke you a little bit, don't mind. You're quite unusual persons. I hope you think deeply about all these things. If you apply your sincerity to these issues, you can do the greatest gift. You can give the greatest gift, give the greatest love. Anyway, I say, admit it or not, you two are into the greatest love. That's what both are into. Admit it or not, I can understand you don't want to say, but that's where you're at. Yeah. You've come a bit up in your evolution to understand that to love, the better, the more unselfish you are, the better the love is. That's where you're at. Now you have to find out what is the most selfless love in relation to what? Is it in relation to neighborhood? Is it in relation to your nation? Is it in relation to just human beings? Is it in relation to the earth planet? What's the greatest love in relation to?
But I don't know whether that's selfless. And that's what I was brought up as a Catholic. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of the teaching was around selflessness. And part of my adult life has been renegotiating that and looking at it in terms of, I'll give you an example which sounds very superficial but I think highlights something a little deeper. I moved into a house in last July with five people, five bedrooms, three bedrooms of the same size, one small, one big. I was on the phone to my mum before I moved in, and I said, I'll take the smallest room, so I don't mind, it's no odds to me. And she says, don't take the smallest room, because you'll take the smallest room, and you might feel good about yourself, because you've done this selfless act, you've taken a small room, and you know that the others might not realise, and you'll feel inwardly very good, even a little bit smug about your own selflessness.
Right.
And someone else gets that big room and feels, you know, a bit lucky, a little bit coy about it. But there's no lesson there. And what we did do is we all discussed who would have each room, what the individual needs of each different person were. And the actual outcome of it was that the three people had the three medium-sized rooms, the biggest room and the smallest room, the two people in them swapped halfway through. So whoever had the smallest room to start off with had the largest room in the end, and vice versa. And that lesson was learned for everybody around what
you're a social utopian. You're a socialist social utopian. I don't say that in a derogatory way, but you know, value. No, it's not a value judgment, but yeah. Still, deeper than that, socialist utopianism is you two are really into love. And you've just figured out a higher level of love than most people, but I say there's much further to go, much further progress to be made. So I'll leave you on that note. It's been very wonderful talking to you both.
Thank you very much.
I hope I get the pleasure again, and it'll be interesting to see your sojourn. You have some cake to share with them?
Yeah.
Okay, please. They deserve it. Thank you very much.
I have a call from Belgium, so I have to deal with that.
But I think you have a lot to think about. Deeply thoughtful persons. Thank you very much.
Thank you.